Hello, this is Chuck from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. When Keith Lockhart left Cincinnati for Boston to lead the Pops and take over John Williams' tenure, he was 35 years old, the same age as Arthur Fiedler at his start. In his 23rd year conducting the Boston Pops, Keith has made his own mark on a classic American institution. Unique collaborations with internationally acclaimed artists and communication with the city of Boston during times of celebration and times of hardship, these are Keith's strengths. We spoke about his years with the Pops, current plans, and some ins and outs of conducting and directing this amazing ensemble. Ben Folds came to Symphony Hall during the week of our conversation, and Keith spoke about this collaboration in particular. We had a good chat and hope you enjoy listening and learning more about our city's Pops maestro. You just heard Devil's Dance from the Witches of Eastwick from the Boston Pops' latest CD, Lights, Camera, Music, 6 decades of John Williams, and we were fortunate enough to get a few recordings from the Ben Folds show we attended that same evening. About halfway through, you will hear Ben and the Pops perform Capable of Anything, and at the end, a cut from his performance of Zach and Sarah. And we could not resist including another piece from the CD, the finale from the suite from Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. We want to thank the kind folks at the Boston Pops for the use of these recordings. So here's our conversation with Keith Lockhart, recorded at Symphony Hall in Boston, Massachusetts.
I was talking to my brother-in-law's mother, and I told her I was going to be talking to you, and she said, oh, mention to him his violin teacher, Engel.
Oh, Betty Engel?
Betty Engel, because I guess they were neighbors. He's there from Schenectady. Is Poughkeepsie near Schenectady?
Or? It is near it, an hour and a half
away. Well, for whatever reason, she knew.
But
she knew her. She's like, oh, tell him. I say, you know.
Yeah, I think her daughter might have lived in Schenectady. No, it's funny. I never really played violin, but at the point I was getting out of undergrad and heading on to conductor school and realized that I had never studied a string instrument, which, you know, two-thirds of the people working for me were going to be playing.
Right.
I decided to take a desperate few lessons. I was 21 or something like that. Yeah. So actually, I think Betty gave me a violin. She was an old lady who was retired from the Hudson Valley Philharmonic and was a church friend of my parents. And so I went over there, and she was very sweet.
Oh, yeah.
She's long passed by this point,
I think. But she was, I was surprised that she kind of had an in with you.
You know,
I guess.
6 degrees of separation.
I think it's less than that now.
Especially around
less
here.
Than that.
In music, it's funny. It's really 2 degrees, because if you don't actually know the person, you know someone who knows the person. And that's pretty much true if you go to, like, Shanghai Phil, you know.
It's how we got you on, because, Ron, you
that's
met him.
That's true,
at,
not
at,
through,
you met
well,
him at
through music. Yeah, this is, it's great to have you here. And walking through Symphony Hall without anybody else in it is kind of a neat thing even for us to do. And to hear some of this, of the rehearsal was
it's
was
relatively
magical.
Peaceful here, isn't it?
It was nice, because I've been to the BC at the Pops, where my family's big in BC. And
it's not peaceful there.
It's not peaceful there, but I mean, you played a lot of John Williams stuff. They did a little medley of all these different pieces that John wrote. And no matter how many times everyone has heard them, everyone's in awe when they hear it live by the orchestra. I even felt it today when I came in and you were playing some Harry Potter. It gave me chills. I don't know what it is about it. But
well, we just finished doing this weekend. We did E.T., the whole film, right, screened with live orchestra playing. And it's amazing how much more impact the music has performed live than when it's buried on a soundtrack.
I know that this is a big couple months for the celebration for John Williams' 85th. When you think about that type of music within the score itself, or within the film itself without a live music, it's powerful. To me, it's exponential to have it right there in front of you. You almost feel it.
The other thing that's interesting about John's music is that it is excerptable from the film and still works. There's a lot of film music, very good film music by very good film composers, that is incredibly boring to do without the film, because it is only written as accompaniment to the film. And John accompanies the film well, but the music has enough integrity on its own that you can take it out of the film and it still makes sense to people.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because when I think about, you know, when I saw Jaws probably way too early as a 5-year-old, and I think that now DSS would.
Have you ever swum again?
My wife's from Maine, and we've known each other for like what 18 years now, and it took probably about 10 years for me to like be more comfortable in the water.
Still scary.
But anyway, I saw it way too early in the theater. But there's something about some of those classic melodies that I think just stick in our brains from when we were kids too, or when we're, you know.
Well, you're right. I mean, they are a huge part of, it's funny with John's stuff and with, in general, the Spielberg connection, is those films really are common currency pretty much all over the world. You have to get pretty deep into undeveloped places to find people whom, if you sing dum bum yep up bum bum, they don't go, oh, that's Star Wars, right. You know, tribesmen.
Few places, right? It's a common language. That's interesting. You know, we're lucky to sit here talking with Keith. You know, you mentioned the 2 degrees of separation. We were at the Spalding event, which Keith has done, and the Pops are part of the Pops for, what, 8 years or something?
Something like that. I'm trying to remember back. It dates back to one of our members, and actually a very influential person here. He's the president of the musicians local in the whole Boston, New England area. He suffered a stroke early, 52, something like that, and ended up in Spalding for quite a bit of time. And he credited them with really giving him back enough functionality to be a performing musician again, which is something when you think of the, you know, the micro coordination required to play mallet instruments. And Pat really wanted to give something back, and we'd already been doing something similar for the kids at Children's every year. And he said, well, can we go over and do something at Spalding too? Which is great, because of course everybody wants to give things to kids at Christmas, and that's a lovely thing. But you know, it's easy to leave out the 60-year-old recovering stroke victim who is there far from home, and their family and their kids aren't around them, and it must be a very lonely place to be at that time of the day.
Yeah,
that time of year.
Yeah, and the fact that you guys do that as a tradition is tremendous, and so it's very much appreciated. And I should give a shout out to Randy Blackshaffer, the physician that sort of. Literally, I should say orchestrated it before I realized I was going to make a bad pun.
But. The conductor of the conductor of the Spalding Tabernacle Choir.
Exactly, yeah, the STC, which I was a member of, Chuck, for a day. The Spalding Tabernacle Choir. Oh.
Yeah, we have a chorus of doctors and volunteers, and I think a couple of patients who join in and sing with the orchestra. And now they're really beginning to feel their oats. They're starting to do solo numbers now. Uh-oh. So
going to the studio soon. All right. So switching gears a little bit. Growing up, my image of a conductor was influenced by two things. First, there was Bugs Bunny in the Leopold thing, which is just so
Tchaikovsky
classic.
And Fantasia.
I mean, it's just unbelievable, right? And then the other one is Arthur Fiedler,
right?
So
every conductor you could think of had white hair.
Right.
And kind of a stern, grandfatherly sort of demeanor.
You became a conductor at a fairly young age, right? You were in your early 20s, correct?
Well, I came here when I was 35, but I had already been working pretty seriously in the profession for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years before that.
Were there influences at that young age? Do conductors have influences in that manner?
Well, I think there always are. I mean, conducting is a very old-fashioned sort of trade, in that it used to be when you'd learn a trade, you would be somebody who had some aptitude. I don't know whether it was goldsmithing or whatever. You would go and you would work with a master. You'd be an apprentice. You'd clean the workshop up afterwards and that sort of thing, and just watch. Eventually, if you had a boss who was caring in that way, you would get some chances to do stuff. And eventually, you'd become a journeyman, and you would still go around and work apprenticed under various masters at the thing. And eventually, you set up your own shop. Well, conducting still works a lot the same way. I mean, you can go to school for it, but it is a developmental thing that really takes years before you have enough to say that a group of professional musicians would really want to hear. Mm-hmm. So what you do is you get your paper, and then you go out into the cold, cruel world, and you do lots of journeyman work for a long period of time. So I have a lot of influences along the way. Not one particular mentor. It was kind of the automatic. It was, you know, some from column A and some from column B. You know, I kind of missed having that one. Some people, you know, were totally glommed on to Leonard Bernstein, for instance, for his whole teaching career. I never had that one person, but on the other hand, I think it also means that you kind of, it's easier to develop yourself and not be a carbon copy of somebody else.
Hmm. I know that when you came to Boston, there was some meetings, of course, with your predecessor.
I actually didn't meet John until about 12 hours before my press conference appointing me.
So,
he stayed very much. In general, people do. I mean, you don't tend to pick your own successor in those situations. Yeah. I'm sure if he had a strong objection to somebody, they would have listened to him, of course.
Yeah, but, interesting. I mentioned that because I read something in, I think it was 2005, that he gave advice, not really worrying about putting your own stamp on the Pops. It's this big institution that's going to last for decades and decades.
That was in that dinner in the night before my press conference.
Right. We had 12 hours.
We had dinner up in his suite at the Four Seasons. They snuck me up to his room because, of course, they didn't want anybody to get a press scoop on the press conference. And the one bit of advice, I mean, he was very genial, but the the one thing I remember that really stuck with me. And it was spoken from quite a bit of experience, and I think also a better knowledge than I had of how Bostonians view their institutions. And the idea was, this is over a century old great tradition. Do not come in and say, well, I know better than that. Let's change this and this and this. Yeah. Or don't give the impression that that's what you're doing at any rate. Be a steward of the tradition. Continue to do what you do best. And eventually, you know, your own predilections and preferences and all that will be reflected in the product. And he was right. I mean, I think it is, you know, I feel very much now that the Boston Pops is, of course, still something greater than me, greater than all of us. And I hope we'll go on long past the time I'm here. But now it certainly feels like my ensemble at this point. I mean, Arthur Fiedler has been dead for 37 years
79,
now.
I think.
79, 80. And, you know, so as we're approaching 40 years from that period of time, and John had a bigger, I think, hurdle that way, in that Fiedler had been there for 50 years. John came in never having met him. There was no pass-off, no succession, because Fiedler basically died on the podium. And, you know, then he had to replace somebody who immediately was a statue on the Esplanade. You know, it's, you know, and amazing. With John, yeah. You know, it was much more of a pass-off. John is still related to the organization. He's still the laureate conductor. It was an easier transition all around, I think.
And what you've been able to do is show that stamp, though, ironically, is that when you look back, we can see that you've brought in some of the current artists, the classic Boston artists. You know, you've collaborated with some of the greats in classical and jazz and rock. And I know that must be a big challenge, is keeping it fresh. What do you do next?
And, it is. I mean, you know, the unlike a traditional music director position with a, you know, a Beethoven, Brahms, Strauss, Mahler kind of orchestra, we are very much more reflective of the world we're in currently. We're less traditional. There certainly are those traditions, but we always have to be looking at what are people listening to now? What is the sweet spot for our audience in terms of nostalgia? When I came in, they were still doing nostalgia concerts that were aimed for people who were born in the teens and 20s, where Glenn Miller was kind of hip, you know, and right. You know, we had to change that, obviously, and they'd gotten stuck in that for a while, and we started realizing that now the people who were teenagers when the Beatles showed up on these shores are now, you know, members of AARP, and time does march on, and so we constantly try to look at it and say, what sort of audience can we attract that we're not attracting? How can we keep the core of our audience engaged? And we have this wide tent with the Pops that you don't have with a traditional symphonic organization, where we say all these musics, you know, Broadway music, world music, jazz, classical, of course, which is the core of what an orchestra is founded to do, all those things fit under this roof, as long as they're good, as long as they're interesting. Arthur Fiedler had a great quote. He said, we only play one kind of music at the Pops, the interesting kind.
Hey.
And I, you know, I like that. You know,
yeah.
we keep trying to make it interesting. We keep trying to do things that we feel we can do good service to, and that reflect well on us. I mean, you're probably not going to get a hip hop night at Pops anytime soon, because it's not what we do.
Right, but it's also about introducing classical music to a lot of the younger folks who may not be exposed to it.
Especially in these days with the decimation of so many school music programs.
Right.
It was a lot more assured that an American kid a generation or two, 25, 30 years ago, would have some sort of grounding in music, some ability to read music notation, some years, no matter how successful or unsuccessful, of studying an instrument or singing on a chorus. And, you know, in the teaching to the test kind of world we live in these days, that's gone by the wayside a lot. I often say thank God for John Williams, because if it wasn't for John Williams, millions of people would have no idea what a good orchestra sounds like playing good music. When you think of the soundtracks that are out there, even of other movies, so few of them make use of the orchestra in a way that is like worthy of the orchestra.
And it's immediately accessible to so many different layers of cultures and socioeconomics.
And you can build on that, because yeah. John's roots go deeply into the classical traditions that all of us at the BSO and the Boston Pops value.
Yeah. Andres Nelson, I saw an interview, you were both being interviewed.
The kid, as we like to call him.
Oh, yeah? That's right. He's younger than all of us, I think. He said that he appreciated your precision and your cleanness of your technique. Now, what is technique for a conductor? Like, what does that mean?
Well, it's... The job of a conductor is a hard one to describe to people who aren't have never worked in a conducted ensemble. But I often describe it as largely first and foremost because people will say, "Well, did you ever play an instrument?" And I say, "Well, that's like asking Belichick if he ever played football. Obviously, he played football. Obviously, he was not a Hall of Famer as a player. He was a student. He was one of those people. There's always people who are better students of the game than they are participants in the game, who have gone through all the things that went through. You know, I put the pads on and did all the drills, too, with all the people who are out there on stage. Did the competitions, did the hours in the practice room. I was a pianist originally. My orchestral background's as a clarinet player. And all those things, you begin to realize that you're one of those people who's better at assembling the project, who is better at saying, you go here, than they are at actually being the person who you're telling to go here to. You can help other people do it better. And I think those are the kind of people who gravitate toward conducting. Conducting technique is the tools you use to get an orchestra to play with very little time together, something of immense difficulty and precision exactly together. It's funny because I think, you know, some people just feel that somebody stands up there and waves their hands around, the orchestra does what it would have done anyway, and if the conductor disappeared, there would be no difference. But the truth of the matter is that no matter how good, even at, you know, Boston Symphony, Boston Pops level, you are, 80 people can't do the same thing at the same time unless there is a common source of information, which is play that note here. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to do that without clicking your fingers and making them do that. And that's harder than it might seem. And technique is, you know, your ability to show tempo, meter changes, precise entrances, things that require, that would otherwise be extremely hard to put together with just your hands and a minimum of words. And that's particularly important in the Pops job. I mean, it's, you use the same techniques as a conductor, whether you're conducting for Queen Latifah or doing Mahler 7. It's conducting is conducting. Hmm. It's the material that changes underneath you. And if you don't have a clean technique in a situation like the Pops, well, when we are formed as the Boston Symphony and we're playing in the weeks that the BSO plays here, they play one program a week. It is usually a very difficult program, but that one program gets four rehearsals. When we play the pop season, we play five, six concerts, usually two to three different programs on one rehearsal, sometimes two. And so the difference is you don't have a lot of time to talk about it or allow them to figure out what they need to do. You basically have to show it the first time.
And it's got to be intuative for the musician when they're looking at you. They know, they have
yeah,
to understand
they have
what
to know
doing.
That you do this and they do this and somehow it's all going to be together. And we occasionally in the Pops have, we sometimes even have to read things on stage that we have never rehearsed together before at all.
Yeah, so talk about that cause and effect. It's fascinating because, you know, you're an interpreter. In a sense, you're communicating an entire 80-person ensemble mm-hmm. with each other. And granted, they become a family, I would assume, where they know each other as well. Mm-hmm. But how does that develop over time? What are some of the challenges? And I don't know if you could sort of just touch on that communication aspect.
Well, there is, of course, you know, the basic thing that in the world of large orchestral music, it kind of evolved. I mean, 200 years ago, orchestras didn't have conductors. And they kind of figured the thing out intuitively. The concertmaster, the first violinist, would often lead the thing when leading needed to be done. The composer was often sitting at the keyboard playing in the middle of this and telling them how he wanted it to go. As time went on, it became obvious that such a large ensemble needed somebody to overlay an interpretation. Music is not an exact notation. It tells you to slow down here, to get louder here. It doesn't tell you how much to slow down here or how exactly to make this tempo change or this mood change between two different sections. That's up to one person to do. That having been said, when you're conducting, you're working with 80 people who are at different levels, very excellent independent artists in their own right. They also have musical ideas. A good conductor does not just squash those ideas under, you know, and say, well, I don't care what you how you'd like to play. This is the way we're playing it. Sometimes it comes down to that. But usually what it is, it's a dialogue. It's a communication. There's a big oboe solo. The oboe soloist decides to take extra time on one top of the phrase, that sort of thing. Do I stop and say, oh, that wasn't in my plan? No, I listen to them doing that. And my technique takes in that space so that I can bring the orchestra back in after they took that time. So it's a two-way street. That having been said, if they're just, you know, doing something that I just can't count and it's in my overall view of the thing, then I say, look, can we play this a little faster here? Mm. Can we not take time here?
I have to ask, how do you actually do that? Will you make an effort depending on the moment to stop the actual flow of the music? Or will you do it after the piece is over and say, you know, when you did this here,
Usually that's the kind of thing. I mean, if somebody is doing something that is totally upsetting the apple cart for everybody else, then you stop and go, well, yeah, could we think of this a different way? Because that's not quite working. Generally speaking, you would go through the thing and say, and, you know, we're going to take time in the next bar, so I'd rather you don't take time there. You know, it's an accommodation, a continual accommodation sort of thing. Most things, though, that you fit within whatever framework you've set up, you should be able to accommodate by listening in real time. You don't have to stop the orchestra and say, Jane is going to take extra time in that bar, so wait. Because what happens is they hear that happening. They say, oh, something is changing in the flow. They look up. They say, oh, that's where my next beat is. And so it's your job to be the physicalization of their ears.
The Boston Pops, it's under the umbrella of the BSO, correct?
Yes.
So it's very unique. Is there any other orchestra out there that has the same kind of orchestra separate?
There's a similar situation in Cincinnati where I came here from. I was the associate for the Cincinnati Symphony and the Cincinnati Pops Orchestras when I got this job. One of the reasons I think they considered me, because it was certainly at that point the other big pops tradition in this country, and was set up by a man named Eric Kunzel as a direct imitation or perhaps direct competition to the Boston Pops. But generally speaking, lots of orchestras do informal series, relaxed stuff, pops concerts, that sort of thing. But very few of them have a separate brand that has become so renowned as the Boston Pops. And it's really, you know, I kind of like this. In other orchestras, you'll play 3 weeks of classical subscriptions, then you'll play a pops week. So it's always going back and forth. In this case, we finish the symphony season, we start the pops season, and it's actually it's a little less whiplash inducing that way.
I wanted to mention, it's a weird coincidence actually, because I worked with Ben Folds during a neuroscience and music and movement symposia last November.
Cool.
But what's interesting about him, I don't have to tell you, is that he has a concerto, right, that he's going to bring to the floor. And I saw an interview with him recently in the Globe that mentioned something to the effect of, when a lot of our like pop artists or rock artists come to stage, they'll have a background symphony. But he views it as more of a collaboration, which is what the Pops do, is collaborate and sort of rearrange some of those classic songs.
And those are really the kind of artists we gravitate toward, too. I mean, there are lots of acts out there where, you know, the orchestra is just wallpaper to them, and you really can't tell that the orchestra is there, sometimes literally because of the difference in volume between highly amplified instant and more unplugged sort of ensembles. Yeah. But Ben, well, I mean, if you know his songwriting output at all, let alone his piano concerto, it's a different way of approaching music. It's a different complexity of music. It's something that cries out for the kind of colors an orchestra has. And when Ben comes, he brings a percussionist, not a drummer sitting in front setting the beat. He brings, you know, the orchestra is basic. It's him and the orchestra fully integrated. And the piano concerto, which we'll do the Boston premiere of, I think. This is my third or fourth time working with Ben, but we've never done the concerto together before. I'm really looking forward to it. It is, you know, he's quite an impressive pianist, actually, and kind of a musical polyglot. And the concerto has bits of everything. There's some very Rachmaninoff sort of sounding stuff in there, and there's some kind of Baroque concerto grosso sort of music, and some perpetual motion Prokofiev. Yeah, I mean, you know, he's obviously a musician who takes the orchestra as a challenge to do greater things, not just play his greatest hits with us playing, you know, long notes behind it.
Yeah, and I wanted to hear your impression about that, because it seems like a unique marriage.
It is, and it is. It's always more work that way. It's easy to just turn your brain off in a company, but in this case, no. There's a reason I've gotten to know Ben a little bit over these last decade or so since we've started working together. I mean, you know, the other things he does, the collaborations with people like Neil Gaiman and Nick Heitner and people like that. He's obviously interested in using what he does to do more and more interesting things.
It doesn't make much sense. They sing it like a pop song. You're capable of anything, and I'm sure they meant you could be president, or you could just forgive me. But I stopped caring what you
Is there like a brotherhood of conductors? Do you follow each other?
No, we hate each other. No. it's not even quite that. You know, it's funny. I used to say whenever I meet, you know, one of my colleagues, we always remark on how there are never two of us in one town. It's a zoning ordinance, I like to say. You know, the thing is, it's a singular profession. Hmm. And when you're young, you know the people you're, you know, in the same group of conductor wannabes with, because you guys go to all the same master classes, all the same competitions. And if you're lucky, you start making the finals of the same auditions. Mm. But as you get older and people, you know, drop off because they don't make it, which is a lot of them. And the rest of us, we all have gigs. And I have to tell you, there are people I have tremendous artistic respect for, but it's all reflected. It's from what my orchestra committee tells me when I come back, or what I've heard of them doing. I've hardly ever met a lot of these people, even people I say, gee, we're going to have you back, and I have them come into my orchestra. I've still never met them because when they're there, I'm not there.
It's almost like just a logistical problem. You just can't be in the same place at the same time.
It's a zoning violation. Yeah. That's only one per town.
Right. You're still active in the UK?
Yes, I'm still the principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra. It's one of five orchestras, believe it or not, that are supported by the BBC. Two of those orchestras are in London, and one of them is the one I'm principal conductor of. I don't generally go in much this time of the year because of the pops. Now, I'll be back there in the third week of July to do, believe it or not, a John Williams 85th birthday prom in Royal Albert Hall, which apparently went on sale 2 days ago and sold out in less than 2 hours, 6,000 seats. Speaking of it being a worldwide brand.
That's amazing.
You're coming out with a brand new recording, right?
The CD was released on the 16th, called Lights, Camera, Music, Six Decades of John Williams. And basically, the hardest part when you're doing a John Williams recording, well, one of the hardest parts would be figuring out what to put on it, but that's kind of obvious. The other one is trying to put things on it that have not been recorded to death. I mean, the world does not need another recording of us playing the main title from Star Wars, because it's been recorded probably 50 times. Mm. So what we try to do instead was find, on the other hand, you don't want a CD that's only going to be bought by the movie junkies.
And all the obscure ones.
Exactly. Yeah. So we tried to blend that, and what we based the album on was the idea that, John... We've only had talkies since basically 1930. The first jazz singer was in 1929. Right. So basically, this is the ninth decade in which we have had films with sound. Mm. John has film credits in seven of those nine decades.
Seven of those nine.
Starting in the mid-1950s. Some of those were, they were not particularly orchestral, or some of them weren't the best movies in the world. He wasn't always John Williams in all capitals, you know, because he had to pay his dues just like everybody else. But we started with movie scores, credits from him in the mid-1960s, and continued up to the most recent Star Wars movie, recording the suite of music taken from that, from The Force Awakens, for the first time.
I want to ask another question about conducting, and we mentioned putting it together with the intricacies of the dynamics and what happens when and how a conductor interprets that for the orchestra. You know, when you study that ahead of time, there must be pieces that you know very well, of course, and ones that you don't know well. I'm so curious how the memory works. Do you rehearse certain bars of that? Do you go through a whole section? How do you commit your brain?
In preparation.
Yeah, in preparation.
You know, the non-glamorous part of conducting, which I'm sure Andres or anybody else will tell you, involves a lot of hours sitting at a desk with an open score, a light bulb, some pencils, and your head. When I look at a score that I've never done, I mean, obviously, at this point in my career, there are a lot of scores that I've done so much that they require more of a dust-off than careful preparation. I will often, if it's a piece I don't know at all, I may listen to a recording of someone's work whom I respect of it first, just to put the sounds in my head a little bit, because, you know, it's easy to hear a Mozart symphony in your head just by looking at it on the page, but you start doing a very complicated 20th century piece, and it's just too dense to say, oh, that sounds just like this, by looking at 38 separate lines on a score. And then I'll put that away, and then I will just start breaking the big chunk. Let's say you have a 15-minute long first movement. I'll start breaking it down into smaller and smaller bits. All of these things have a structure. To me, you find out the structure, the underlying skeleton of it is the key to learning the piece. And it's the key to memory and remembering how long this is. So it starts off as a 15-minute chunk, gets divided into, you know, two chunks, three chunks, depending on how it is structured. Eventually ends up in phrases and phraselets and motifs and little three-note things that are used throughout. And then after you break it down, it's just like, it's like learning, you know, how your car works, like you used to be able to do by taking your car apart. Can't do that anymore. Nope. Because you would never get it back together. But in fact, you can't even get into it to take it apart. The challenge becomes after you, you know, you say, oh, that's what a carburetor looks like, and you take these parts apart, is putting it all back together so it works again. And so I think that's what I do. I take the car apart into its tiniest pieces, and then I start reassembling those pieces. The conducting stuff, the technical part, it never gets practiced.
You're driving.
It's, yeah, yeah. You're
driving. Car.
Exactly. You know, you're studying the map, and then you drive.
Right. That's, I like the analogy there. I read somewhere Arthur Fiedler, as a hobby, he would travel in his car and follow fire trucks to fires and watch them work.
He would, yes, actually. I'm not sure. There are probably words for that.
But it's probably illegal.
Oh, good. So you don't do that, too.
No.
So I just wanted to know. No.
So I mean, you know, if you're going to have a hobby, it's a pretty cool one.
It's pretty cool.
It's,
and he had a scanner. And he would get in a car, often with David Mugar, the founding producer of the 4th of July, who would, as he got older, would drive him around on these chases.
And that's awesome. I heard he's like an honorary fireman in certain, you know, firehouses.
Yes,
around town.
What, his Walter Mitty other job, you know?
Yeah, it's fantastic. So what, when you're trying to relax, when you're trying to chill out, I know that you don't listen, I've read that you don't listen to music much because you,
because the last, as you know, the best thing, I can't remember, some reporter some years ago, I said, you know, I never listen to music in the car. I listen to NPR.
Right, that's I heard, I think, yeah.
And then they said, yeah, you know, I'll bet PGA golfers don't play golf on the weekends. I said, exactly that.
Yeah.
Because why would you do what you do for a job for the time when you were relaxing?
I hear you.
But, you know, I used to have lots of good pat answers to that. I loved to ski. I loved the outdoors when I was younger. I did a lot of backpacking and stuff like that. Don't do much of that anymore.
And you have a kid,
I like
too,
to play
now,
tennis.
Too,
so I have a 5-year-old and 7-year-old at home.
Oh, wow.
And
so that takes
a 13-year-old who lives with his mom, all boys. And the 5-year-old and 7-year-old pretty much take the available time,
right.
Though we have, my wife and I have a little retreat on the Cape, on a really quiet corner of the Cape that we
nice.
Like to run to, and we've just gotten really foolish and bought a boat, and
uh-oh.
So now the rest of our time is spent, you know, both A, trying to figure out how to use the boat,
yeah.
and number two, trying to figure out how to pay for the boat, so.
Yeah, that's... You're trying to keep it afloat.
Exactly. Any one of the kids more interested in music, do you think?
All of them, the oldest plays cello. I think he really likes it, but he has absolutely no intention of being a professional musician. And the younger two, too early to tell, they're both playing piano. They're both extremely musical. I think the youngest one, the 5-year-old, if any of them end up going into dad's line of work, it may be the youngest one, because, well, the youngest one was playing his piano for his lesson, and I sit and practice with him when I'm home, and I'm playing an accompaniment underneath him, and he said, well, and will you sing the words too, because there's words in this song, you know, but, and he's just learning to read, so, you know, so I'm singing the words and playing this, and I said, through instead of two or something like that. We finished the song and he said, Dada, that was very good, except you sang the wrong word when you say, I said, conductor baby. All you do is listen and criticize. Yeah, great.
That's great.
That's great.
Well, Keith, really appreciate your time and sitting with us. I know you're a busy guy, as I said. And
thanks for the great conversation.
Oh, we appreciate it. Have a great summer, man.
We'll try.
Yeah, enjoy the boat.
Yeah, enjoy the boat.
Can't wait.
Yeah, I bet. All right. Thanks very much.
Sarah Spell without the H, who's getting bored? Not a PV amp in 1984. Balzac without a C, tried out some new guitars. Playing Sarah with no H's favorite song. La da 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 da, la da da. La da 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 da, la da da. Zach and Sarah. Often Sarah would have spells where she lost time. She saw the future, she heard voices from inside. The kind of voices she would soon learn to deny. Because at home they got her smacked.
Keith is as nice a guy in person as he seems when you see him on the stage. It was so great to talk to him, and we would like to thank not only Keith, but also the gracious people at the BSO and Symphony Hall for their amazing hospitality. You can see what is going on with the BSO and the Boston Pops, and also purchase their new CD at bso.org. They have some amazing performances scheduled, and even have the B-52s coming to the Pops on June 13th and 14th. And you can go to our brand new website at abovethebasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique. Gaining Ground grows organic produce for hunger relief with help from an army of volunteers, and they give it away to people who need it for free. Throughout the harvest season, produce from Gaining Ground's farm goes to food pantries, meal programs, and shelters in Greater Boston and Eastern Massachusetts. Their approach is local and sustainable, and most of their produce is distributed within 20 miles of the farm and within 24 hours of harvest. To learn how to support Gaining Ground and for more information, please visit gainingground.org.